And I wanted to speak about the path, you know, and how often, you know, that feeling can come up, you know, like there's so many obstacles in the path and they are obstacles for practice. But then if we really, you know, stop and consider, then actually it's the obstacles themselves which make the path. The path is just like one obstacle after the next. And some of them, you know, are really big. And others are just like, you know, we don't even notice them. So, and you know, through being willing, you know, to open up and stay conscious with that, we mature and we grow in wisdom and compassion. And, you know, that's really what the path is all about. And I just want to start with a poem by one of the enlightened Arahant, bhikkhunis at the time of the Buddha, and her name is Bhikkhuni Tissa, and she says, "Find your true home on the path. Find the path right here, in the center of your own heart. If you keep searching in the past and searching in the future, you will search and search, but your searching will never end. If you keep searching in the past and searching in the future, you will search and search, but your searching will never end." And that's, you know, basically saying the path is in the present moment where we are just right now with whatever it is. That's the path, and whatever it's happening, you know, we can use it to, you know, open and learn from it and be changed by that experience. And then, you know, through repeating that opening like a million times or more than that, really, you know, we will be changed by that experience. And it's that letting go, yeah, which is very difficult to explain. You know, by doing it again and again, we get a taste of that open mind which has let go. And then we become more and more confident that this is actually what we are looking for. It's not things, it's not, you know, particular experiences, but it's that letting go of wanting anything, which is when we are truly feeling, and a feeling of fulfillment, a feeling of connectedness with our life and with ourselves and with others, and a feeling of all wishes are fulfilled because there are no wishes at this very moment. And you know, through repetition, we just train ourselves to have more and more confidence in that resting in awareness. And then, of course, you know, the mind slips again into holding on or defending against something, and then as we remember it, we let go again, and then again it's like this taste of freedom for a moment only, maybe. And it's this, you know, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, which is the practice. And then through the repetition, we become more and more, you know, courageous, really, and even, you know, more and more challenging situations, we remember, oh, letting go. And then we sleep again, and then letting go again. It's a skill and which we learn through training ourselves in trusting that openness of the mind. And, you know, it doesn't mean, you know, that all problems are solved, but it's a different place from where we connect with whatever is happening in our lives. You know, and taking a different having a different angle on all of this, not taking it so personal, and you know, having a sense of curiosity and a sense of faith in the teachings, that it really works. And you know, if you have a lot of ideals, that's, then it's very difficult, because there's a lot of shoulds and should nots in the mind, and that makes it very difficult to you know, to stay conscious, because the stories, you know, can be very, very convincing. But then, you know, over the years, I have observed, you know, myself on the path, that over the years, you know, it's always the same stories. And then over like 10 years or so, you know, you still notice I'm still, you know, falling for the same stories. So it becomes like a little bit easier, you know, to wake up quicker to it. And, you know, remembering, you know, being conscious of the ideals we have. It's not that we shouldn't have any ideals, but to be conscious of them. That's what's really important here. Because it's, I think it's very good to have a guiding star for one's practice, but then, you know, to kind of try to really become that is very counterproductive. But rather, you know, becoming aware of the arising and ceasing of perfection as well. And the arising and ceasing of difficulties. And it's about that, you know, it's about trusting the arising and ceasing, trusting the impermanence of whatever it is, a perfect experience or a difficult experience or a boring one. That's what they all have in common, and that's what's liberating. To notice that impermanence of all of those experiences. And then to have, you know, the mindfulness and the courage and the clarity of mind that we remember that, you know, whenever we are caught up in something, to just making it conscious. That's all what's needed. It's not that we shouldn't have this thought or that thought or anything. It's just about making it conscious and then stepping out of that identity into, you know, this much bigger space, opening the mind and letting go. And, you know, that really matures us. It burns away attachment. It just burns away those patterns of mind, you know, which some of them have very strong underlying conditioning from maybe early childhood, where we have experienced some really, you know, difficult trauma maybe. And then that doesn't go away quickly. It can take a very long time, and, you know, we carry it probably through lifetimes. But through making it conscious, we can start, you know, to gain some perspective on it. And, you know, allow those obstacles on the path to be actually our gifts, you know, our opportunity to train ourselves. And, you know, often the most difficult experiences can be, you know, an opening onto the path. In my case, I think many of you have heard it already, but in my case, it was, for example, the death, the very sudden death of my mother when I was 28 years old from a horse riding accident. She died, and you know, that was a very shocking experience for me then, and it opened me, it matured me very, very quickly. Because until then, you know, I had used quite a lot of strategies to distract myself from suffering as good as that was possible, you know. And some of those substances and different things, what I did, they were rather unskillful. They didn't really fit into the five precepts, I must admit. And you know, through the sudden death of my mother, I was really jolted out of that because I felt like I don't want to waste my time anymore because this is something I really need to understand why things like that can happen. So that really matured me to the extent that I was ready, you know, for some kind of a teaching or some kind of guidance, and I was ready to, you know, to apprentice myself to something. And then, because it says, you know, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And then, yes, within 1.5 years, I happened to find myself, you know, at the feet of my first teacher, who was a Thai forest master. That was 1988 that happened. And I still remember very well, you know, because everybody was bowing to him, and I was just saying, I'm never gonna bow. I'm not gonna do this. And I was staying at the monastery there and was working in the kitchen. And I remember one day the head cook in the kitchen just took my head when we were sitting in front of Ajahn Buddhadasa and just pushed me down on the ground like 3 times like that. And I just didn't want to make a fuss, so I just went down with her like that. And then, you know, I felt really kind of very weird at that moment, but somehow the ice was broken. And then next time I tried it, you know, on my own, and I was like, hopefully nobody's gonna see me, because I had a very you know, very Western, let's say, idea of bowing down is, you know, kind of becoming dominated by somebody else, and all of those ideas we can have about this, you know, physical position of submission, really. And then, you know, I got the taste of it, and then it became a relief, you know, to have somebody or something worth bowing to. I felt a sense of relief, really. And then from then onwards, it was easy. So when I came then to Amaravati a few years later, I was already well trained in bowing, was not a problem. But then there were other things which were a problem. I remember the most difficult one was that the men and women, you know, had to bring the tray with tea or food on their knees, you know, to the monks. And when I saw that, I got really again, I said, I'm never gonna do this. Absolutely no, this is crazy. What kind of a place is this? And then, but then also I started to think inside myself, you know, if I would be able to bring a tray like this and not have a nervous breakdown, I think that would be a huge accomplishment for me. So I was another obstacle on the path, you know. So I took some rescue remedy and say, today I'm gonna bring the tray, because if you made breakfast, you had to bring the tray to Ajahn Sumedho on your knees. So I had a few shots of rescue remedy, and then I just, you know, went on my knees with the tray and gave it to him. And afterwards, I felt so happy that I was able to do this, because I'd overcome like a something I never thought I'd be able to do, because I would feel so embarrassed doing it. And then, you know, after like a few times, it became no problem. And then the next thing was, then I became an Anagarika, and then we had to always, one of the Anagarikas had to do a little chant to invite the teacher of the day to give a Dhamma talk. This little chant where Brahma Sahampati, you know, comes down from the heavens and asks the Buddha, you know, please give a teaching out of compassion for those with little dust in their eyes. And this was a little 4-line chant in Pali. And I thought again, I can't be an Anagarika because I can't do this chant in the temple in front of so many people. I can't do it. I can't do it. And even before I was in theater and I was like performing in front of hundreds of people, it was no problem. But I just thought, this chant, I can't do it. But of course I did it, because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to be an Anagarika. And again, you know, after I did it a few times, I felt so relieved. So I think you could probably get it what I wanna speak about. It's those, you know, those obstacles. Some are really rather small and maybe ridiculous, like those I was just mentioning, but some can be huge. And if we can take them, you know, as an opportunity to stretch the mind and the heart, then we are on the path. And you know, this way of dealing with our lives, you know, to really use everything, what's happening, as food for the practice. You know, this is a teaching I've heard very often when we were in Amaravati, with Ajahn Sumedho. You know, Ajahn Chah was emphasizing that a lot, and that the practice, you know, in those monasteries of the Ajahn Chah lineage, they're very much geared towards community practice, where, you know, lots of people are living together who normally would not live together, but because they all have that aspiration for training and they all wanna, you know, maybe ordain at Amaravati, that's what brings them together. Same here, like at the Loka Vihara as well. You know, we are a very interesting group of people who might not ever have met if they wouldn't have the same aspiration, you know, to practice the Dhamma and to, you know, want to be bhikkhunis and want to get bhikkhuni training. That's what all, you know, keeps us together here. And this, you know, community practice can be very powerful if, you know, we do have the capacity to keep on opening, even in the most, you know, and difficult situations. You know, not opening to anybody in particular, but opening to our own inner experience and to the external things, you know, which are happening to us. This constant opening, 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 and opening again. And then in particular, if, you know, we are not able to leave the ideals we have, you know, the ideals which brought us to this path. Like for me, you know, I was very inspired by, you know, by my first teacher, by his presence, by the way he conducted himself and everything. And, you know, in the beginning, I was very naive and thinking, oh, you know, having this teaching about the four foundations of mindfulness, you know, that's a, if you know that everything is impermanent, it will be easy, you know, to just deal with my experience. But then it turns out it isn't that easy. You know, theoretical knowledge is good to have it, but then, you know, when we are really challenged and, you know, the on those levels, body, mind, feeling, tones, and storylines, all of that, you know, mixing up together into a huge kind of orchestra of input. It's very difficult to stay steady with that, to stay conscious. And, you know, living in a community is, you know, is ideally the right mixture between, you know, support and challenge, so that, you know, we do have the support in order to, you know, to stay on the path and to have a certain kind of, you know, regularity through the schedule and through having certain duties to fulfill and you're working together as a group, and through that regularity, you know, there's the certain kind of you know, worries or certain concerns are falling away, and then there's more capacity to ideally, you know, look at our own experience. And then at the same time, you know, through living together, there's a lot of different things which arise by, you know, being in a situation where you very often do not get, you know, your way, would be your preferred way of doing things or eating things or not doing things and everything in between. So the practice, you know, in the Ajahn Chah tradition is in particular about that. You know, using the community as a support for waking up. And, you know, this constant remembering to let go of our preferences and, you know, allowing the different attachments, you know, which we become conscious of through living together with others, you know, to just become conscious of those stories and then maybe, you know, let it go for a moment and then it comes up again. But then over the years, you know, we start to notice certain patterns. And then ideally, you know, through long, long, long repetition, you know, we start to kind of grow a little bit out of certain stories. And that's different for everybody, you know, which stories are coming up first. And then there's, you know, capacity increases to not believe in certain stories anymore. And then they drop away and then the next layer comes up. And the next layer comes up and gets, you know, deeper and deeper in over time. So it's a very powerful tool, you know. And then sometimes also for people, it comes to the point where they feel, okay, it doesn't work anymore for me. And then they go somewhere else or they put down the ropes and become lay people again. And then some people come back again and take the ropes again. So there's many different ways, you know, how the practice can happen. But as a you know, general underlying principle, it's about, you know, using whatever is happening as a challenge and opening to it and, you know, allowing ourselves to be changed by that experience. By seeing the impermanence of it, most of all. Seeing, you know, the arising and ceasing. And then, you know, in even very challenging situations, we can remember, oh, this is impermanent too. I don't necessarily have to make such a big deal out of it. And then if we really, you know, are able to not suppress it, but really able to stay steady with it, and we do see the ceasing of it, you know, that instills a sense of confidence that next time, you know, maybe we can take something on which is even more challenging. And then, you know, our life starts to open up. So in that sense, you know, this constant opening, sometimes, you know, there are experiences which are very, very difficult and we can't see a way forward. And then if you're open to it, and then the path appears. Even we, you know, we think there's no way forward with this. But then, you know, the path just appears. The path is made by walking. You probably have heard that before. There's like a sense of there's no way forward with this. And then, you know, if we really allow ourselves to be with the experience consciously, we will know what is the next step. We don't necessarily know, you know, the next 10 years ahead, but we know the next step, and that's all we need to know. And that's that saying, you know, the path is made by walking. just knowing the next step and the next step. And really, you know, becoming more and more confident that this is the way to open to the experience. That doesn't mean, you know, that we allow to become doormats of, you know, certain scenarios, but it means opening to it, you know, seeing what is our experience, seeing what is happening, and then from that openness, you know, making the right response, which sometimes is to say no, and sometimes is to say yes, and sometimes is to stay, and sometimes is to go. That's different every time, and also different for different people at different times of their life. But nevertheless, you know, the clarity and the, you know, right response comes from allowing oneself to fully experience what is. And there's another poem here in this book from Maddie, which speaks to that. And this bhikkhuni is also called Tissa, Tissa the Third. And she says, "Why stay here in your little dungeon? If you really want to be free, make every thought a thought of freedom. Break your chains, tear down the walls, then walk the world as a free woman. Then walk the world a free woman." Break your chains and tear down the walls. You know, those are the attachments, of course, you know, in terms of reactivity or holding on or defending or going unconscious. There's different ways. And, you know, you probably know what yours are. But I know mine. And then walk the world a free woman. You know, which doesn't mean there won't be any difficulties in the world anymore. There's still old age, sickness and death, and, you know, people losing things and, you know, being challenged. All of that is still all happening, but meeting it from a different place. You know, a foundation from which we can, you know, really be a fully embodied, you know, human being, where we can allow ourselves to really be part of this world. But not to be completely identified with it. So to stay in relationship, it's not about, you know, turning away from the world or being aloof, you know, in the sense of not wanting to have anything to do with it and wanting to control one's life to the extent that, you know, there is no more challenges, which is anyway impossible. But, you know, many of us have tried and have seen that it doesn't really work. And here she says, you know, make every thought a thought of freedom, which means, you know, letting go. As soon as we are noticing and we're holding on to something, just letting it go, even just for one moment. And then letting it go again and again and again. And then over time, through that training, you know, the chains get broken and the walls are crumbling. And then it becomes, you know, easier and easier to rest in that open awareness. You know, and then be able to participate in the human experience fully and you know, become like those fully enlightened nuns at the time of the Buddha, you know, who were able to really care from a place of strength and love but they, you know, were including themselves in that. They didn't lose themselves and their, you know, and their direction, what they were working on. And still, you know, they were able to stay connected and stay in relationship and help others. And I brought a little snippet of a note which I have, which is from, is a blessing from my first teacher, which he wrote with his own hand, Ajahn Buddhadasa. And I think it's like a summary of that poem. And he says, not to be sad, not to be glad, but with equilibrium forever. So that's, you know, in a way, the same thing. You know, make every thought a thought of freedom. And, you know, I don't think he means with not to be sad, that we shouldn't be sad, but not identify with that. And not to be glad, not to identify with that, but to stay, you know, stay in the middle as good as we can forever. And of course, we can't do it forever, but we can come back to it again and again and again. And I have that on my shrine because it's a very good advice, and it's a good blessing, you know, for all of us, for our practice, to, when the going gets tough, to just remember that, you know, just remember to open, just for one moment. And then, you know, if we familiarize ourselves with that, how that feels, you know, it's an acquired taste, because it's just so much more what we really want. You know, the sense of ease and that sense of being where we are, rather than, you know, having that sense of lack or sense of overwhelm. And that's, you know, what the practice is really all about, that letting go. And, you know, in all schools of Buddhism, so many different skillful means and paraphernalia and outfits and chants and instruments and, you know, a huge spectrum. And everything is geared towards that letting go and towards, you know, training ourselves to be more and more able to rest in that openness. And to, it's an acquired taste. In the beginning, it's just like hard work, and it's just like there's nothing there, because we have to refine, you know, our minds and hearts to be able to taste it. And that's, you know, what can be called, you know, the development of the seven factors of awakening. They are all about, you know, refining the mind, sensitizing the mind, so the mind can actually taste what that is, because it can't be described. It can be only, it's like, you know, the finger pointing to the moon, but then we have to just look. And the looking means, you know, just letting go. And then, you know, even just for a second, for a split second. So yeah, reading that one more time of Ajahn Buddhadasa, the blessing. Not to be sad, not to be glad, but with equilibrium forever.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.